Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The National Broadcasting Company brings you an address by the President of the United States on the fourth anniversary of his first inauguration as Chief Executive of our nation. We're broadcasting from the brilliant Victory Dinner at the Hotel Mayflower in Washington, where are assembled some 1,400 guests, including the President, his cabinet, members of both houses of Congress, and many other famous personages and loyal friends of the Democratic Party. All are happy and joyous on this occasion, celebrating the victory of their party at the polls. There are more than 1,100 other similar gatherings in progress throughout the country, all with their radios tuned to this broadcast.
And now it is my very great pleasure to present to this very fine gathering and to the radio audience the President of the United States. Mr. Tumulty, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, on this 4th of March, 1937, in millions of homes, the thoughts of American families are reverting to the 4th of March of another year. That day in 1933 represented the death of one era and the birth of another. At that time, we faced and met a grave national crisis. And now we face another crisis. A crisis of a different kind, but fundamentally even more grave than that of 4 years ago. Tonight, I want to begin with you a discussion of this crisis. I shall continue that discussion next week in a nationwide broadcast, and thereafter, from time to time, as may be necessary. I propose to follow my custom of speaking frankly to the nation concerning our common problems. I speak at this victory dinner not only as the head of the Democratic Party, but as the representative of all Americans who have faith. Faith in political and economic and social democracy. And incidentally, our victory was not sectional. It did not come from compromises and bargains. It was the voice of 27 million voters from every part of the land. The Democratic Party, once a minority party, is today the majority party by the greatest majority any party ever had. And it will remain the majority party so long as it continues to justify the faith of millions who had almost lost faith, so long as it continues to make and modern democracy succeed. So long and no longer. We are celebrating the 1936 victory. That was not a final victory. It was a victory whereby our party won further opportunity to lead in the solution of the pressing problems that perplex our generation. And whether we shall celebrate in 1938 and in 1940 and in 1944 as we celebrate tonight will deservedly depend upon whether the party continues on its course and solves these problems. And if I have aught to say about it, it will continue on its course, and it will solve these problems. After Election Day in 1936, some of our supporters were uneasy. Uneasy lest we grasp the excuse of a false era of good feeling to evade our obligations. They were worried by the evil symptom that the propaganda and the epithets of last summer and fall had died down. Today, however, those who placed their confidence in us are reassured. For the tumult and the shouting have broken forth anew and from substantially the same elements of opposition. This new roar, for that's the best term, is the best evidence in the world that we have begun to keep our promises, that we have begun to move against conditions under which one-third of this nation is still ill-nourished, ill-clad, and ill-housed. We remember that we gave warning last November that we'd only just begun to fight. Did some people really believe that we didn't mean it? Well, I meant it, and you meant it. A few days ago, a distinguished member of the Congress came to see me to talk about national problems in general and about the problems of the judiciary in particular. And I said to him, John, I want to tell you something that is very personal to me, something that you have a right to hear from my own lips. I have a great ambition in life. My friend pricked up his ears. I went on. I am by no means satisfied with having twice been elected President of the United States by very large majorities. I have an even greater ambition. By this time, my friend was sitting on the edge of his chair. I continued. John, I said, my ambition relates to January 20th, 1941. And I could feel just what horrid thoughts my friend was thinking. And so in order to relieve his anxiety, I went on to say, my great ambition on January 20th, 1941 is to turn over the desk and chair in the White House, this desk and chair, to my successor, whoever he may be, with the assurance that I am at the same time turning over to him as president a nation intact, a nation at peace, a nation prosperous, a nation clear in its knowledge of what power it has to serve its own citizens. A nation that is in a position to use those powers to the full in order to move forward steadily to meet the modern needs of humanity. A nation which has thus proved that the democratic form and methods of national government can and will succeed. And in these coming years, I want to provide such assurance. I want to get the nation as far along the road of progress as I can. I do not want to leave it to my successor in the condition in which Buchanan left it to Lincoln. My friends, that ambition of mine for my successor can well be the serious ambition of every citizen who wants his United States to be handed down intact to his children and grandchildren. I spoke in the dead earnestness of anxiety, and I speak to you tonight in the same earnestness. For no one who sees as a whole today's picture of this nation and the world can help but feel concern for the future. To the President of the United States, there come every day thousands of messages of appeal, of protest, of support, of information and advice, messages from rich and poor, from businessman and farmer, from factory employee and relief worker, messages from every part of our wide land. Those messages reflect the most striking feature of the life of this generation, the feature which men who live mentally in another generation can least understand, the ever-accelerating speed with which social forces now gather headway. The issue of slavery, for example, took at least 40 years, two generations of argument, discussion, and futile compromise before it came to a head in the tragic war between the states. But economic freedom for the wage earner and the farmer and the small businessman will not wait like emancipation for 40 years. It will not wait for 4 years. It will not wait at all. After the World War, there arose everywhere insistent demands upon government that human needs be met. The unthinking, or those who dwell in the past, have tried to block them. The wise who live in the present have recognized their innate justice, their irresistible pressure, and have sought to guide them. In some countries, a royalist form of government failed to meet these demands and fell. In other countries, a parliamentary form of government failed to meet these demands and fell. In still other countries, governments have managed to hold on, but civil strife has flared, or threats of upheaval persist. Democracy in many lands has failed, for the time being, to meet human needs. People have become so fed up with futile debate and party bickerings over methods that they have been willing to surrender democratic processes and principles in order to get things done. They have forgotten the lessons of history that the ultimate failures of dictatorships cost humanity far more than any temporary failures of democracy. And in the United States, democracy has not yet failed and does not need to fail. And we, leaders of the Democratic Party, throughout the nation, Do not propose to let it fail. Nevertheless, I cannot tell you with complete candor that in these past few years, democracy in the United States has fully succeeded. Nor can I tell you under present circumstances just where American democracy is headed, nor just what it is permitted to do in order to ensure its continued success and survival. I can only hope. For as yet, there is no definite assurance that the three-horse team of the American system of government will pull together. If three well-matched horses are put to the task of plowing up a field where the going is heavy, and the team of three pull as one, the field will be plowed. If one horse lies down in the traces or plunges off in another direction, the field will not be plowed. What you and I call the principles of the New Deal did not originate on the 4th of March, 1933. We think of that date as their beginning because it was not until then that the social demands that they represented broke through the inertia of many years of failure to improve our political and economic processes. What were those demands and needs? How far did we succeed in meeting them? And what about them today? Ever since the World War, the farmers of America had been beating off ever-mounting disasters. This administration tried to help them effectively where no other administration had dared to take that risk. The Agricultural Adjustment Act testified to our full faith and confidence that the very nature of our major crops of America makes them articles of commerce between the states. The AAA testified also to our full faith and confidence that the preservation of sound agriculture is essential to the general welfare, that the Congress of the United States had full constitutional authority to solve the national economic problems of the nation's agriculture. And by overwhelming votes, the Congress thought so too. You know who assumed the power to veto and did veto that program. In the campaign of 1936, I said, of course we will continue our efforts in behalf of the farmers of America. With their continued cooperation, we will do all in our power to end the piling up of huge surpluses that spelled ruinous prices for their crops. We will persist in successful action for better land use, for reforestation, for better marketing facilities for farm commodities, for a definite reduction of farm tenancy, for encouragement of farmer cooperatives, for crop insurance, and a stable food supply. For all these things, we have only just begun to fight. My friends, neither individually nor as a party can we postpone and run from that fight on the advice of defeatist lawyers. But I defy anyone to read the majority opinion invalidating the AAA and tell us what we can do for agriculture in this session of the Congress with any reasonable certainty that what we do will not be nullified as unconstitutional. But the farmers were not the only people in distress in 1932. There were millions of workers in industry and commerce who had lost their jobs, young people who'd never been able to find their first jobs, and more millions whose jobs did not return them and their families enough to live on decently. The Democratic administration and the Congress made a gallant, sincere effort to raise wages, to reduce hours, to abolish child labor, and to eliminate unfair trade practices. We tried to establish machinery to adjust the relations between employer and employee. And what happened? You know who assumed the power to veto and did veto that program. The Railroad Retirement Act, the National Recovery Act, and the Guffey Coal Act were successively outlawed as the child labor statute had been outlawed 20 years before. Soon thereafter, the nation was told by a judicial pronunciamento that although the federal government had been thus rendered powerless to touch the problem of hours and wages, the states were equally helpless, and that it pleased the personal economic predilections of a majority of the court that we live in a nation where there is no legal power anywhere to deal with its most difficult practical problems, a no man's land of final futility. And furthermore, for I'm not through yet. Court injunctions have paralyzed the machinery that we created by the National Labor Relations Act to settle great disputes raging in the industrial field and indeed to prevent them from ever arising. We hope that this act may yet escape final condemnation in the highest court, but so far, the attitude and the language of the courts in relation to many other laws have made the legality of this act also uncertain and have encouraged men and corporations to defy rather than to obey it. In the campaign of 1936, you and I promised this to working men and women. Of course we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America, to reduce hours over long, to increase wages that spell starvation, to end the labor of children, to wipe out sweatshops. We will provide useful work for the needy unemployed, and for all these things we have only just begun to fight. But here again, we cannot afford, either individually or as a party, to postpone or run from that fight on the advice of defeatist lawyers. And I defy anyone to read the opinions concerning the AAA, the Railroad Retirement Act, the National Recovery Act, the Guffey Coal Act, and the New York Minimum Wage Law, and tell us exactly what, if anything, we can do for the industrial worker in this session of the Congress with any reasonable certainty that what we do will not be nullified as unconstitutional. During the course of the past 4 years, the nation has been overwhelmed by disasters of flood and drought. Modern science knows how to protect our land and our people from the recurrence of such catastrophes, and knows how to produce as a byproduct the blessing of cheaper electric power for the nation. With the Tennessee Valley Authority We made a beginning of that kind of protection on an intelligent regional basis. And with only two of its nine projected dams completed, there was no flood damage in the valley of the Tennessee this winter. But how can we confidently complete the Tennessee Valley project? How can we extend the idea to the Ohio and the Connecticut and many other rivers and valleys of the nation while the lowest courts have not hesitated to paralyze its operations by sweeping injunctions? My friends, the Ohio River and the Dust Bowl are not conversant with the habits of the Interstate Commerce Clause. But we shall never be safe in our lives, in our property, or in the heritage of our soil until we have somehow made the Interstate Commerce Clause conversant with the habits of the Ohio River and the Dust Bowl. In the campaign of 1936, you and I and all who supported us, men and women of all parties, we took cognizance of the Ohio River and the Dust Bowl. We said, of course, we will continue our efforts for drought and flood control. For these things, we've only just begun to fight. Here, too, we cannot afford, either individually or as a party, to postpone or run away from that fight on the advice of defeatist lawyers. Let them try that advice on sweating men piling sandbags on the levees in Louisville and Cairo and Memphis. But I defy anyone to read the opinions in the TVA case or the Duke Power case or the AAA case and tell us exactly what we can do as a national government in this session of the Congress to control flood and drought and generate cheap power for the nation with any reasonable certainty that what we do will not be nullified as unconstitutional. The language of the decisions already rendered and the widespread refusal to obey law, incited by the attitude of the courts, create doubts and difficulties for almost everything else for which we have promised to fight. Help for the crippled, for the blind, for the mothers, insurance for the unemployed, security for the aged, protection of the consumer against monopoly and speculation, protection of the investor, the wiping out of slums, cheaper electricity for the homes and farms of America. You and I owe it to ourselves, individually, as a party, and as a nation, to remove those doubts and difficulties. And in this fight, as the lawyers themselves say, time is of the essence. In three elections during the past 5 years, great majorities have approved what we are trying to do. To me, and I am sure to you, those majorities mean that the people themselves realize the increasing urgency that we meet their needs now. Every delay creates risks of intervening events which make more and more difficult an intelligent, speedy, and democratic solution of our difficulties. As chief executive and as the head of the Democratic Party, I am unwilling to take those risks, risks to the country and to the party, of postponing one moment beyond absolute necessity, the time when we can free from legal doubt those policies which offer a progressive solution of our policies. Floods and droughts and agricultural surpluses, strikes and industrial confusion and disorder cannot be handled forever on a catch-as-catch-can basis. And, my friends, I have another ambition. Not so great an ambition as that which I have for the country, but an ambition which, as a lifelong Democrat, I do not believe unworthy. It is an ambition for the Democratic Party. The party and its associates have had the imagination to perceive essential unity below the surface of apparent diversity. We can, therefore, long remain a natural rallying point for the cooperative effort of all those who truly believe in political and economic democracy. It will take courage to let our minds be bold and find the ways to meet the current needs of the nation. But for our party, now as always, the counsel of courage is the counsel of wisdom. If we do not have the courage to lead the American people where they want to go, someone else will. Here is one third of a nation, ill-nourished, ill-clad, ill-housed, now. Here are thousands upon thousands of farmers wondering whether next year's prices will meet their mortgage interest. Now, here are thousands upon thousands of men and women laboring for long hours in factories for inadequate pay. Now, here are thousands upon thousands of children who should be at school, working in mines and mills now. Here are strikes, more far-reaching than we have ever known, costing millions of dollars now. Here are spring floods, threatening to roll down again upon our river valleys now. Here is the Dust Bowl, beginning to blow again. Now, if we would keep faith, faith with those who had faith in us, if we would make democracy succeed, I say we must act now.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking at the Democratic Victory Dinner on the fourth anniversary of his first inauguration as President. This is the first of two major addresses the President is scheduled to deliver within a week. The crowd is standing and applauding the President's address, and he's waving back at them. He's going to leave the Hotel Mayflower in just a moment. Thank you. applaud, and still they waved their hands with a smile, a cheery smile in return from the president.